I'm Kieran.
And I'm Eve. This is Kitchen Table Cult.
We're two quiverful escapees talk about our experiences in the cultish underbelly of the religious right. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Kieran.
How are you today?
Time zone. Time change has fucked me up. So I'm here, but oof. At what cost?
I have 2 weeks to go before the time change hits Germany, which just furthers my belief that big daylight savings is bullshit, because I do 6 and 9 hour math all year, and for 2 weeks on each side of the time change, my math is wrong and my schedule is fucked and I can't talk to people at the right times because it's so annoying. I don't like it.
Well, I'm glad we got the math for this one right.
Yeah. It took a couple times because I was like, wait a minute. Google's supposed to figure this out for me, but it didn't. It's rude.
Google is useless these days. Hi, Kate. We have a guest here. You want to introduce yourself?
Sure. Thanks so much for having me. I'm a big time fan of the show for years. And my name is Kate West. I use she, her pronouns, and I live in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I was a former stay-at-home daughter, and now I'm writing a book about it. Actually, I already wrote it. It's coming out on April 30th.
Yay.
It's called Rift, a memoir of breaking away from Christian patriarchy. So I'm really excited to share my story, and I keep calling this the year of the stay-at-home daughter because I think a lot of us are speaking up this year, so I'm excited about that.
Yeah.
We have a total glut of memoirs from our world.
I have mostly
world.
Been reading memoirs since January. It's like, this is the year everything is getting like, I don't think it's going to end this year. I think it's going to continue, hopefully, because I'm still working on writing mine. But like, the wave is starting. I'm very excited about it.
Yeah.
Well, and as we were just talking before the show starts, like, that kind of tracks with the timeline that I'm familiar with for like really high quality memoirs are usually like a decade after whatever happened. Mm-hmm. And then you have like 2 years for the publishing cycle. So like, that's about right. Cause we were just talking that we all got out in like 2013, or you and I did. Kieran was out a little earlier.
Yeah. It's been a little bit over 10 years. It's wild.
It doesn't feel like that. It feels like it's been so much longer and also like not at all.
Yeah.
How trauma works that way.
I woke up today and saw that Gamergate 2 was happening. And I was like, did I just go back in time like 10 years back to like, I don't understand what is happening right now.
I would like Gamergate 2 to not happen because the way it changed the internet last time and like the entire like politics of our universe is really bad. Let's not.
Yeah,
do that again.
Yeah. No, I feel like Gamergate is like a huge part of my multiverse theory, where like things like split off in 2015 with the Berenstain Bears. Like, is it an E or is it an A? Happened the same time that Gamergate was going on, and I'm like, yes. We somehow got shunted into the bad reality. I want the Star Trek one where the Berenstain Bears ended with an A. Thank you.
Yeah, we live in Berenstain Bears, and it's all fucked. We weren't encouraged to read. We had a couple of them, but we weren't encouraged to read those books because they were disrespectful to the father.
Oh yes. Yeah,
I was gonna say I was not allowed to read those growing up.
We had like three that were approved.
Yeah, I had more than three, but I wasn't allowed to read the ones where they were like disobedient. But they had some like the Berenstain Bears go to church, or like it's Easter, so they had some like weirdly Christian ones, and those ones were,
you sure that
fine.
Wasn't a Vision Forum knockoff?
I mean, you know, it may have been. Maybe that's why I thought it was spelled differently.
I feel like they are Christian books, actually.
There's like a moral in each book. Or like, I vaguely remember there was like a very like moralistic line, like, and I'm like, this is, as I got older, I was like, this is a bit on the nose, actually.
It's VeggieTales levels of overt on the nose stuff.
Yeah.
But you didn't come here to talk about Berenstain Bears.
Well, I'm ready to go on a deep dive, you know, like, who published them? I'm pretty sure it was a Christian publisher. We could go on a deep dive.
We could just say that. Yes. Oh my God.
We're here to talk about Rift, but really we're going to get to the bottom of the Berenstain Bears conspiracy.
One of the things that I love about this book and other books like it existing, so like Shannon Harris's memoir and your memoir and like a couple others, like Educated, I'm like, I can just hand this like reading list pile to someone and be like, here are the things I'm not talking about in my memoir that were my story. And like, this is one of those. It's like, this feels very familiar. I was all but going to be a stay-at-home daughter. The only reason I didn't is my father had some sort of like bone of contention with his father about homeschooling being good enough to get someone into college. So he had to like prove that I could get into college. And then I did. And then I got really good scholarships. And so it was like, well, that's how that is.
Showed them.
Yeah. But like, I remember I got a full ride to VCU, which is like the state college in our town in Richmond, Virginia. And my mom was like, you could just live here and help around the house and go to class. Like, you could do that. And no. I was like, nope. Absolutely not.
You've seen what it can look like outside.
Yeah. Not going to go to college, then come home and have to do an entire day's worth of chores and homework somehow.
Yeah. So this really resonated. Like, you do some things with the structure where you're talking about, you talk about geology, you talk about like the indigenous history of these places you were living. But you also talk about like the books that you were reading along the way. And that's kind of one of your running motifs is you're summarizing these books. And you talk a lot about like reading being a really big part of your life as a stay-at-home daughter. So I was curious to hear you talk more about that and what the role books played in your life. You've got the like huge bookcase right behind you full of books.
Yeah, a little bit obsessed with books. yeah, it's kind of funny because now my day job is working with books and I read books in my free time. So it's kind of my whole life. But it started when I was really young. My mother would read to me before bed or she would tell me stories. And that's when I felt safest and felt like alive the most, when I could hear stories. Mm-hmm. I struggled with socializing. And when my parents pulled me out of kindergarten to homeschool me, you know, that's when I was starting to learn to read. And so it was a way for me, I don't know, like a way to socialize with other people's stories in a way.
Yes. Yep. Yes.
When I didn't have a lot of interaction with other people. So I think it just always was important to me, and I always wanted to write stories, and I would make up little books out of like paper and construction paper and printer paper. And I just always wanted to tell stories, and I didn't know how to tell my own for so long because I was afraid of what I had to say, I think. And so I repressed that so much. But yeah, so books have always been a way for me to think about life outside of my own world. Mm-hmm. But then it became a way for me to reflect on my own world as well.
Yeah. I'm curious your comment just now about like being afraid of telling this story, and like, you want to talk a little bit about how the book came about? It's really interesting to me because this is the book I decided not to write on many, mm-hmm. many levels. And I'm really, really excited that you did. But I'd love to hear like how it came to be.
Yeah. So when I left in 2013, I wanted to go to college and study fiction writing. So obviously there's a lot of steps to go from zero work experience and zero education to a writing degree. So I started out at community college, which was a really good experience for me. And eventually went to Michigan State, where they have a creative writing program for a bachelor's. And I was taking fiction classes, but I also had to take an additional genre. So I picked creative nonfiction. And, you know, I wanted to write fiction, but even in my fiction, my story was leaking into that. And then I was taking these nonfiction classes, and I was like, I think that there's something I need to get out of my system to write about. Even though I was like hiding it for so long, I just wanted to forget what had happened and just move away. But that didn't work very well. Like, that's not how you process trauma. So writing became a way for me to work through that even before I could afford to go to therapy. Mm-hmm. And it became my creative writing thesis. I was going to make it into essays about this, and then quickly realized this is a much bigger story for one essay. And so I needed to make it into a book.
Yeah. It's relatable.
Yeah.
There's a point where you talk about writing your first essay in your community college class, I think it was, which mm-hmm. big fan of community colleges. And I thought you were going to like give us like a snippet of it right after you discuss that in your next chapter, but you chose not to. And I'm curious, like, what was your essay? Like, how did you have the same like perspective that you do now? Like, as you're like thinking about what's important to tell in these stories.
That first class, you know, I had to write a personal essay. I think it was only like 2.5 pages long. So it was very short. And it was less than a year after I had left. So I still didn't understand a lot of what had happened to me. All I knew was there was like this before time when I was controlled and had all these rules and felt oppressed. And then this after time now when I was like at college and making my own choices. So I feel like at that time it was pretty vague, you know, the arc that I was telling, but it still felt like this before and after. I just didn't have a lot of language, and I'm pretty sure I used the word patriarchy because I did understand that was the movement I had grown up in. Mm-hmm. And so trying to explain that to my workshop group was all men. So it was like, I was a little nervous about that, but they received it, you know, and I felt really heard in that moment. And now years later, writing about this so much more, I have so much more to say. There's so much more detail. I see things much differently now because at the time, you know, I still wanted to make some version of Christianity work for me.
Mm.
And now I've let go of all of that and I feel even more liberated. So, you know, I keep changing. I think that's just normal. But yeah, I see things quite differently now.
That makes sense. I remember when I was just sort of getting out, I was also processing through writing, and I started processing through fiction for the same exact reason. Like, I didn't have the language. I was just telling like sort of this memory, but like put in an alternate world, where I'm just like working through everything that happened. And then I wrote like a 5 or 6 piece, like kind of timeline series of essays for this one ex-Quiverful Moms blog, which I wrote when I was like 19, and I was still like trying really hard to hang on to my faith and like taking responsibility for the like abuse that I endured at the hands of my parents. And looking back on that now, I'm like, well, that's where I was when I was 19.
Yeah, I feel like there's no shame in that. I think that it's important to be transparent about how long it takes and what it takes to change our minds when we come out of these kinds of groups.
Yeah.
I feel like having the language to describe what you experience is one of the biggest pieces, is like coming into feminist theory and like realizing there were terms to describe the like specific things, like the financial abuse element and like mm-hmm. those other things. Like, you're like, oh, this is like a commonly known phenomenon. And like, there's already like academic work on it. Like, this is something that's not new or unique to me. That can be like really powerful. I really related to your section where you're talking about like writing your letter of an essay to your dad about emotional abuse. Because that's kind of the things that I did with mine too.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because you think you can reach part of them to convince them that they're doing that to you.
Yeah, because all they need is like, they don't have the word for what they're doing. So if they have the word for what they're doing, then you guys can like collaborate to like fix it.
Right.
And like, they keep saying that they want the best for you. So obviously they would want to know this information.
Yeah, right. they mean that because they're totally sincere about that, obviously.
Yeah.
And the hardest thing is that they think they are sincere. Like, they truly believe they're sincere about it, but they just, the thing that I've been kind of, processing in therapy lately, as my parents have, for the first time in about 10 years, kind of were lightly speaking again. And by that, I mean, I'll, tell them about a trip that I've gone on in Europe and send some pictures. Like, it's very top level, very shallow. But it's, I started out with those kinds of, here is how you hurt me. Here is why that hurt me. And, they cannot see that they did that because that breaks their entire sense. If they acknowledge how much pain that they inflicted when they were trying very hard to not inflict that pain, that they can't hold that. That just breaks their sense of identity and their sense of who they are, because their identity has been so wrapped up in this ideology. Mm-hmm. And it's a very, I feel like it's painful for everybody. And I'm not saying this to give sympathy where it's not due, but it's just this hurts on all sides.
Yeah.
And it's really shitty because they think that they're showing love, but that's not how that's actually working for the person that is supposed to be receiving mm-hmm. the love, because it's two different scales. It's two different, there is a rift, which your book is conveniently titled.
It's a really good title.
It's such a good title.
And, I think, and compared to how maybe they were parented, it does look a lot different than how mm-hmm. they were parented. So
right.
I think you can understand that and also hold them responsible for what they've done and what they continue to do, if they don't change.
Yeah, exactly.
Both can be true.
I mean, I think that there's an element of this where we dealt with the frustration of, at least I did, and I think you probably relate to this, of I did everything right and I didn't get the payday that I was promised. Mm-hmm. I think they're also experiencing that when we leave. My mother has expressed this many times. This is she's I was raising these good Christian kids and these values that I really believe in, and we were doing it right. And she also didn't get the super stable, happy family that she thought she was getting because of the investment she made.
That's true.
That doesn't make it our problem.
Yeah.
But it is a very similar kind of dynamic.
That is interesting, because definitely my dad did not get what he was promised. None of his kids follow his ideology, mm-hmm. and we all have different kinds of interesting relationships or non-relationships with him now. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's interesting to see it from that perspective. But maybe that would be a calling of oh, maybe I should think about what I was believing.
Yeah. I mean, what do you do with this information? What we did with this information is sometimes I'll run into a situation where someone who is 10 years out like us, hasn't, moved on in certain ways. And I'm we have the same data. We have the same data. What happened?
Where did you make a different turn? I don't understand.
This adds up this way for me. Did you not do the same math?
Yeah. It's big daylight savings. Yes.
It is. Yeah. One of the other things that really struck me, and we were kind of chatting about before, was how you talk about you left your family and you felt that meant you left the patriarchy and all that bullshit behind, which is same. Mm-hmm. And I left, I was yes, now I'm done. I'm out here in the real world where Obama was in office and things were nice. And gay people were given the right to marry by the court, and things were looking up. And then suddenly it didn't stay in Fundy world. It came into the mainstream, and I was but I left this shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's coming back. It's following us.
Why?
Yeah. It's so frustrating because you you see it for decades, you know what it looks like. And then other people have never seen it before. And so they just don't understand the context, I think, the way that we might. And plus, I think, like, just societal patriarchy, I think that was also a bummer to come out and be like, oh, like, secular patriarchy also exists.
Yes.
What have the feminists been doing with all this time since they started this project? Like, it's not done yet.
Yeah, yeah. I was told the feminists were winning, and I came out and
Where are they?
What happened to them?
They all went home.
Where did the work go? I am looking here and I am not seeing the results. What what is going on?
I came to this march and all I got was a pussy hat.
Oh yeah.
I was told that there was gonna be like accessible birth control and autonomy and equality, and none of this exists. Yeah. What? Yeah. Why?
I was struck because my first job was at this little bakery, and you had to be a certain gender to have certain roles in the bakery. And you were, I was one of the ladies, like that was my title. That's how they referred to us, and only the ladies could serve customers. So that was my first job outside of Christian patriarchy. And then my first landlord, like, refused to work with me. He would only talk to my husband because, like, I clearly didn't understand how things worked.
And let's just pause here for a minute. The year is, like, 2014 at this point, right?
2013, like, yeah.
2013. So we're not in the 1970s.
No.
You are allowed to interact with your landlord.
Yeah.
And also, like, none of us knew what we were doing. This is true, but...
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and also I didn't move to a very... evangelical part of the U.S. I'm in West Michigan, so there's like a Dutch Reformed heritage here.
Yeah,
I've learned a lot about that since, because I did not grow up Dutch Reformed, so that's been interesting.
It's a very specific breed.
Yeah, it's very interesting. But still, you think you would get a job and an apartment and not have to deal with the things that we grew up with, but it was such a bummer, a letdown.
So how are you feeling about this book coming out, talking about these things in an election year with Project 2025 on the horizon? Like, there's some really overt connections here that maybe most readers are not going to be making.
Yeah. I mean, I'm tempted to say it's a God thing, but I probably should.
Yes, this is providence. This is God's sovereign foreknowledge.
It's strange because, I mean, I started processing this for myself a decade ago. I started writing this book 6 years ago. And publishing takes so long, writing takes so long. And so it just happened to be that my book comes out this year. And that's also the election year, where we're doing another Trump-Biden election, which is fun. And... it's just kind of wild that that's relevant. I'm talking about the past, but really I'm talking about the present, And I think that's partly why, like, my overarching metaphor in the book about rifting and geology is, like, these things come back, it's not like you can just bury the past, but it always comes back. It's all connected. So, I'm feeling a little anxious about it, but we shall see.
The book ends with your father being a kind of impotent figure, but then you talk about Kevin Swanson. You want to kind of explain what that connection is? And
thank you. You're the first person to ask me about that, because I do name him in the book.
You name him a lot on purpose, and I want to talk about that.
Yeah, and I was very intentional about that. I've done a lot of thinking about that. I had to be very careful with what I said, and that's why there's a lot of footnotes. And I had to go back and listen to his sermon recordings, which was not fun.
Ugh.
But it was also validating. Like, I'm not crazy. He did say these things. And, when I was a kid, I was in his church around 2001, like the early 2000s. And so things like 9/11, Hurricane Katrina, he would preach from the pulpit that these are God's judgment on sin, specifically homosexuality. And so he was very much homophobic. Like, that was his, a lot of the things he talked about from the pulpit was about that. And he just yelled a lot about like hell and fear and how the world is going to come get your kids. And like, you know, I think he made people feel like they belonged there because they were afraid of the outside world in this church that we were part of. But then, you know, he was part of the statewide homeschooling. He was the, I think, either director or president. I can't remember which word it was, but of the Christian homeschooling organization in Colorado. And then he started his own radio program, which is still going.
Yeah. So why might people know him outside of this world?
So he's, you know, he's well known in homeschooling world, but then he says very outlandish things, and he became politically involved. He ran for governor at one point. And then in 2016, he was the moderator or the organizing speaker at a political convention with, my mind is like shutting their names out. I don't remember them. But Ted Cruz.
With the regular who's who.
It was 2016, right? And so I saw on the news my old pastor at this political convention talking about How to Train Your Dragon and like how gay that was. Yeah. And, you know, these terrible things. And how America's like going to hell and stuff like this on TV because he's at a political convention and Ted Cruz is there. And it's like very confusing at the time, you know, to realize like this, my past religious world is like intersecting with like the current political environment. So not a fun moment for me, but.
No, and I'm sure it's not the last.
No, it's not like this stopped. Like, no. I don't know what Kevin Swanson has been up to in the last like 8 years, but he's still doing shit. And like the ideology has like it has become more prominent in like the more kind of, I hesitate to say mainstream, but like I guess it has become mainstream, like GOP political world, where it used to be just like the core base, right? Like our very like Christian nationalist, Christian dominionist, like fundamentalist, like parents and people we listen to, like Michael Ferris, for instance, used to be like this tiny little portion of the GOP. And now because they've been training our generation of homeschooled kids since the 90s and earlier, it has become much more of like a prominent wing of the GOP. And so seeing that all come, I mean, I'm saying this from the like person who went to all the like Team Pat camps and Jin Jay camp and shit. So like I literally sat under these people and got their training to infiltrate the party. And now it's like, oh, you did the thing that I opted out of. Cool. Yeah. Great. Yeah, they love to see many of Congress doing this, like Mike Johnson, for instance, like totally hook, line, and sinker part of this ideology and is now Speaker of the House and trying really hard not to fart during the State of the Union. That's my theory about his reaction.
I know. It is wild, you know, he's so high up in the government. I think it's easy to dismiss like, oh, he's just Speaker of the House, but he's second in line to be president if something happens.
Yeah.
And like he would totally be an elder in my church. I think he would fit in perfectly.
He adheres to very familiar things, like the relationship with his son, having his like covenant eyes access, like it's like all of these things. Wrong. There's so many things. Not to mention just like his face, his expressions are just the same as my father's, like the disapproving, like intentionally like exaggerated, I don't approve of this statement reactions to what Biden was saying. There was one moment that was really good that I just can't get over where he like clearly had not heard a fact that was being mentioned before. And he was just like, you know, like, what?
Cannot compute.
You can see the question marks over his head. A thought bubble, exclamation mark.
Does not fit into this system.
What is this fact? Do I need to accept it? No, I will go back to containing my fart for the rest of this.
Studied constipation.
Yeah, and it just, you know, seeing the plan all along coming to, you know, coming to reality. It's, I want to say it's terrifying. I'm a kind of a person that I don't like fear mongering, and I don't want to like repeat the mistakes of my parents of like, mm-hmm. let's be afraid of everybody. But I think we should be concerned and should, you know, keep having these conversations and try to make a difference, because they're very well organized, the people who want the government to be Christian and white supremacist. Like, they're very organized. You don't always see them. They're very well connected. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We all know that, but
yeah. Yeah. It's not something that we're raising the alarm on idly, like, just because we're like, I feel like there's probably a lot of initial response to how we talk about this stuff that like is, oh, you're just bitter, and not just from people from the church, but I'm just like, oh, because this is personal to you, therefore, like, you think that this is a big deal, and that's not really the case here. Like, this is a big deal for everybody.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is actually documented to be a big deal. And if you, you know, did your research, you would agree. Something that I'm really, really trying to be careful about when I write about this and like even doing this podcast is like, because I also like don't want to just fearmonger. I don't want to be like, you know, this is bad, the world is ending, there's nothing I can do. I always try to find a way that brings it back to like, you know, this is still a solvable problem. We have not crossed the threshold where we can't like go back or we can't do anything about it. And even if we do like cross that threshold, there's still things that we like, there's never any point where we can't fight back. Mm-hmm. It's just harder. It's just more work. But that's like, because I grew up listening to so much fear-mongering about the outside world and how like CPS is just going to come get you if like your kids are outside playing during school hours. Like, I know how effective that is for organizing people, but that is, one, not sustainable, and two, not true, and three, mm-hmm. like, we can do so much better. And if you take away like the hope of success by just like making everyone be afraid all the time, then like you're not actually solving the bigger systemic issues that exist, because like their whole world, this whole ideology operates on like fear as the motivator.
Right.
And the biggest thing to combat fear is hope, which like we saw Obama do campaigning in 2008. It was fucking great.
isn't this also like a really big thing in your book? Like, the, you talk about religious OCD, which is something that we like discussed recently with Anna Gasmarian about her book Devout. Like, this is a thing that I think people are starting to talk about more, but you know, also talk about like not having the ability to have a vision for what your life would look like until you had like other people outside this world like taking you seriously, that like what you were experiencing was wrong and harmful.
Yeah, because on one hand I had the, you know, the vision of my father of, this is what you're going to be and this is what you're going to do for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. And so when I finally found a way to get out of that, you know, I had to realize first that that was not going to work out very well for me. And when I left, it was like, well, anything could happen. You know, there's no limitations. So that's not quite true. Obviously there are limitations. I found that out, but like reading books as a kid, you know, and as I got out and going to college and talking to people from different backgrounds, I was like, there are so many different ways to live and to be a person. And it's not like, I was always thought, you know, it's black or white. There's always box one or box two. You're either one or the other. There's no fence sitting, which there's more than three options even, you know, there's lots of options.
There's so many.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the more we try to make this simple, the more we fall into extremist types of ideologies, you know, that can actually harm people.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I think for me, one of the biggest sort of like awakening moments that I had when I was early on kind of like deconstructing stuff was realizing that like fundamentalism exists outside of the church. Yeah. Like it is just, you can be whatever ideology and still fall into that mentality because it's very black and white and it's very simple and it's very comforting. And when you're scared or overwhelmed or just like going through it, the thing that your little brain latches onto is something that is like an easy solution. So I've always been very vigilant about like, there are no easy answers, actually. Yeah. There is no yes, this, no, that. It's not, the world is not as binary as it would comfort us to be.
Yeah. And I think that's partly why I wrote about nature a lot in the book and thinking about geology. Like, I'm just interested in that personally, but then it became a way of me stepping outside of my individual experience and taking this, you know, cosmic big picture view for just a moment and realize, you know, I'm one tiny person. I can do what I can do. And there's so much more to the world than that, than me. And that sounds scary, but for me, it's comforting, you know, because I can't fix everything. I don't have to be the white savior. I don't have to be this sacrificial martyr that I was raised to be.
Mm-hmm. I mean, from a theological standpoint, that's like a really like liberating like part of this journey, is like realizing that like your tiny decisions about how you're going to follow these like arbitrary rules is not going to affect the larger outcome of the universe or God's kingdom or whatever. Like being able to just detach that and like let yourself be small in the context of the universe and time and history, like, it's very liberating.
Yeah. And I think before, you know, I was like paranoid about every little thing I did or thought. Yeah. And that's the religious OCD part of like, every little thing I do condemns me to eternal punishment, you know? And so you hyperfixate on everything you do when you believe that. And that's what I was told to believe. So yeah, getting rid of that whole system of belief of I am a limited person. I do have choices, but they're not all powerful choices, you know, to like determine the future for everybody. That sounds crazy, but that's just how it worked for me to figure out that I needed to get out of that kind of thinking.
Well, it's also like, it's a way, we've talked about this so much on here, but like, this is a way that they make us self-regulating so that we don't leave, so that we're expending this energy on like worrying about our motives and not just our choices, but like our thoughts and like, you know, how we feel about things. You talk a lot about like not being able to help feeling a certain way, being like one of the like big like roadblocks to following your father's like rules for you is like, I can't stop feeling the way I feel. And like by keeping us preoccupied with being our own, like, like spiritual purity cop in our head, like it prevents us from seeing the big picture and getting out. And so it's like really huge to be able to understand that.
Yeah, I mean, I've been thinking a lot about nervous system regulation and how when you're dysregulated, all the bad choices or like, you know, survival mindset choices you might make. Yeah, I've been really thinking a lot about that because I see that a lot of places, not just religious fundamentalism, but just any kind of fundamentalism.
It's developed. It's something that's carefully like cultivated and like it has such a high cost on your like your emotional like regulation, your like somatic regulation, all of these things.
Yeah, like the Katie Britt speech she did after the State of the Union, where she's like, I feel like that's what she was doing to people. She was using all this emotional tone, which felt very performative. I think that's an understatement, but just saying things about like the border and immigrants and like making people feel afraid for their daughters and mm-hmm. this is a party for families, like you're preying on people's sense of safety, I think, and you're tapping into that fear and keeping them there instead of helping them feel secure, you know, I think. Yeah. And that's a scary place. That's a scary part of politics, is preying on people's fear.
Yeah. And I think the choice to have her be the one to do it was also very, very intentional.
Oh, yeah.
Because, like, it's this woman who is young and a mother and white and from the South and, like, speaking for all other
and, like, able-bodied
young
and
white women from the South. Yeah, yeah. Like,
in her kitchen. You know,
in her kitchen, at her kitchen table.
Her kitchen table.
Which, like,
you can have her on the podcast. God,
I know.
You know, we get pitched conservatives all the time. We might just
be should.
On for fun.
Oh my God.
I'd be on a panel discussion with her. That'd be fun.
Oh my God. That'd be so funny.
Well, because I feel like it would be interesting to see what she has to say, like, in her regular tone of voice and when she's not performing.
When she's not auditioning for the role of the pastor's wife?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, but yeah, I think it is interesting when they choose a woman to have those speeches, because they're talking about very patriarchal, colonialist types of ideologies, but they're putting it in the voice of a woman, which sounds, I think, what they think is sounding softer. Mm-hmm. And making it more palatable to people and
yeah.
more easy to receive. And that is disturbing.
Exactly. And if a woman is advocating to get rid of her mm-hmm. own autonomy or supporting getting rid right. of her own autonomy, then other women who are now afraid because of the things that she said will be like, oh yeah, sure. I mean, I guess it's fine if she says it's safe,
yeah.
which mm-hmm. I think is a huge, and that just like feeds into something we were talking sort of before, is like how women enable and enforce mm-hmm. these patriarchal systems, because, you know, the ones at the top benefit from it. And that only happens so long as they keep themselves and everyone else who listens to them in line, perpetuating the same harm. And so it's like keeping her own privilege and being like, well, you know, if you wear this fancy diamond cross necklace, then you too can be a successful wife and mother who also happens to be a senator like me, and demonize all the people that you don't like and get away with.
It is so Phyllis Schlafly coded. It's
I was gonna say,
oh, it really is.
Yeah.
And it's just ironic. We saw that too in like Christian patriarchy and stay at home mm-hmm. daughter world, where women would become pretty powerful within that world, but only mm-hmm. if they conformed to the ideology, right? And so they could yep. be, you know, like Doug Phillips' wife, Belle Phillips, and
yeah, I was gonna say CF the Butkin sisters.
Yeah,
exactly. And so, like, as long as they're following the line, they can have a voice, right? And they mm-hmm. can stand up, but. Yeah.
But the second that they cross over that line, then it's, you know,
you
get Amy Grant, it's bad.
Yeah.
Amy Grant. Oh, my God. Oh. So what do you think people are going to take away from this book? Do you think anybody from this world is going to read it and, like, consider getting out? What do you think is going to be the response?
Or what do you hope?
I mean, I think it depends on who's reading it. I do hope that people who are stuck in situations without choices are going to, well, first have the option to read it and then mm-hmm. see that there are other options. You know, I don't want to make anybody do something they don't want to do, but I do hope that people feel the need to stand in their own agency wherever mm-hmm. they are. I would be interested to see what people who are still in the Christian world, because patriarchy, I think Christian patriarchy is just saying all the same stuff out loud that a lot of other churches believe and just keep it under the, you know, under wraps.
Yep.
So I am interested to see if people who are kind of like in that subtle, soft patriarchy space, what they will say about it. I'm a little worried that people will just say, oh, she's a fringe. That was a fringe movement.
Yeah, they'll do No True Scotsman with it.
Yeah. But I hope that with, you know, the way politics are and the way we're seeing real life consequences for this kind of belief system, that they'll take it seriously and say, like, it's not just a niche topic. It is going to impact. It is impacting lots of people, and it's going to impact more people if we vote these kinds of people into office. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Because even if they're not trying to keep their women as stay-at-home daughters, they are trying to, you know, control their vote and control mm-hmm. their uteruses and control yeah. like all these other things. Like it's not, it may look very different, but it's ideologically very similar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's, I think it's challenging for people to really claim the truth of that, because it's easier to take something down when it's not quite as harsh sounding as what I grew up with. Mm-hmm. But it's still, I would say, quite as damaging to your, you know, to yourself and to your, the way of interacting with the world. So I hope it starts conversations. I mean, I've had an interview or two with people who are kind of in that world. Mm-hmm. And I think because I'm sharing my own story, it's more accessible for mm-hmm. them to hear it. Mm-hmm. And that gives me an opening to talk about, you know, the beliefs that led to the consequences. So I'm hoping yeah. it gives those kinds of opportunities, because I used to be part of that. I needed people to help me out. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm so glad that you wrote this.
Thank you. Me too.
It was so relatable. And I was just like, so my secret to reading memoirs and not losing my mind is I turn read aloud on and I play Minecraft. So I'm like occupying the like side of my brain that would get activated while I'm like listening to information. I had to like remind myself, I'm like, no, you got out. Like you made it. And it was very powerful and very relatable. I'm just so glad that it's gonna be out soon and people can read it. And
pre-order this one.
Yeah. And something that like you talk a bit about is how like, you know, reading books, but also like blogs and community, like the sort of Homeschoolers Anonymous, the like people who are leaving, like those of us who are writing our stories out at the time was really helpful. And we get a lot of emails and stuff sometimes like how I'm looking, I'm like in this situation, I'm looking for resources. Like What would you tell people who are like kind of stuck and still like trying to escape? Like what is your piece of advice that you would give people?
I'm going to first say something that my friend Claire Heath McIver says, is that take a breath when you feel like, oh, I need to get out. Like take a moment, unless you're in like immediate danger. Like take some time to think through what you want and what you want to mm-hmm. do.
Yeah, not a like reconsider getting out, but just think about what's next.
Yeah,
right. Make a plan. There are so many more people now than there were 10 years ago talking about this, and there are tons of resources. I have a resource page on my website I'm starting to build. There's a lot more therapists who are becoming trauma-informed and religious trauma-informed. Mm-hmm. And so just knowing that there's going to be people to help you when you do leave is hopefully heartening, because it is scary, you know, to leave something like that. But I would say take your time, follow what your inner self is saying, and that's going to take some practice to figure out what your voice is out in the middle of a lot of overbearing voices. And for me, writing, even if that's in a journal, can be really helpful to process what you're feeling, because your feelings do matter, no matter what people are saying to you.
I'll just like do a little coda on that. One thing I really liked about what you told about your journey out was how your body was reacting before you were ready to go. Mm-hmm. And like, I always think it's really important for people to take those body signals seriously, like the panic attacks and the impulse mm-hmm. to run, like very viscerally related to that experience, those things too. And I think that's like, you know, taking a beat to like acknowledge what's happening and like plan your way out, and also like tell your body that like you hear it.
Yeah.
Like these signals this are being heard. Valid. These signals aww. Are being listened to.
That's so important, because for so long, even after leaving, I was like, we need to just stuff these, you know, PTSD symptoms away, because like mm-hmm. this is debilitating, panic attacks, mm-hmm. all those things that you experience with complex trauma. And, but really you need to listen to them so you can process it and figure out what's going on, you know? And sometimes it just means to heal so that your body knows you're in a safe place. But yeah, listening to your body, definitely something takes practice and
takes
time.
A lot of work.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Makes and now sense. We're here. And like,
now we're here.
Adults who have digested this and gone to therapy, and like, yeah. you've got a book out.
Yes.
I know, it's exciting. Yeah, we were talking earlier, I'm doing a surgery next week for a hysterectomy. And I talk about that at the end of my book of like infertility and that kind of journey. But I was writing some today about how I didn't know I needed help until I started listening to my body. You know, like I was sick and I didn't realize it because I had been so used to stuffing that down. And I was sick a lot as a kid.
Yeah.
I would just hide it. I'd be like, doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that I'm sick. And so after going through lots of trauma therapy and actually realizing how much pain I was in, that's when I got help, you know, went to the doctor. Is realizing that my body was sending me signals and I was just ignoring them. So mm-hmm. it can really make a big difference on your life to know what's going on.
It's weird, but it's like your body knows what's up physically.
Yeah. Which is why women and everybody should be able to say what happens to their bodies, but just my opinion.
Yeah.
We'll end on that note. Wow. I'm so glad you're getting the help you need. You're getting the medical care you need. And I'm so glad like this book is going to be out in the world and people are going to hear this story and be able to like have yet another very vital like model of how to get out mm-hmm. if they want it.
Yeah. There's a lot of ways to get out, or you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to sharing this book with my therapist. Like, here is another resource for your next client who's like me. You're welcome. So for the people listening, it's coming out April 30th. Where can they get it? Where can they find you and your writing? Are you doing anything fun for book stuff that people should be marking their calendars for?
Sure. My website's katewest.com. I also have a newsletter. You can find links for everything on my website, but I'm on socials at Kate West Writes, most platforms. And I am starting to plan book launch events. The first major one's going to be in May in Grand Rapids, Michigan, where I live. And it's May 9th. It's going to be in conversation with Kristen Cobus DeMay, which I'm really excited about. She endorsed the book and it's been really helpful.
Dream team right
yeah,
there.
Yeah, I'm excited for the conversation. She's awesome. So that's going to be in May. I'm having all my events on my website. So hopefully I can come visit wherever you live. Just let me know which stores I should come visit.
Yay.
Yay. Yeah. Cool. Well, thank you so much for joining us. This has been super fun. I was super excited.
It's been a delight.
No, thank you so much. I've been listening to your show for so long and you've helped me a lot just processing and understanding, you know, the complexity of these things. So thank you so much for all the work you've been doing.
Thank you. And thank you everyone for listening to the latest episode of the Kitchen Table Cult Book Club, which is what we're calling this now. We will see you next time. Drink water.
Bye.
Bye. You've been listening to the Kitchen Table Cult podcast. Our music is from the track Janet by the band The Heavens on their album Stenazzo. Our producer is Dave the Great. Our podcast is made possible by Patreon donations from listeners like you. To support us and join our community on Slack, check out patreon.com/kitchentablecultpod. Thanks for listening.